This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, anger over his handling of a sexual abuse case involving a student costs the principal of St Kevin's College his job. And this today from Brisbane, I came out of my house and saw a woman on fire. That was the shocking scene that's left three young children dead in a horrific act of family violence. Also, another day, another case of wage theft. Tonight, how is it pushing workers into poverty?
And we can see that people who are working really hard to make ends meet, delivering really good quality products and a good service where they are, finding it just hard to keep going because the hourly rate really doesn't cover their living expenses.
The headmaster of Melbourne's prestigious Catholic boys' school, St Kevin's, has resigned today. He's been under pressure since Four Corners revealed he had written a reference for a sports coach who was eventually convicted of grooming a student at the school. Stephen Russell is to be replaced for the time being by a Catholic school principal who has been widely praised for his determination to make schools safe for students. Samantha Donovan has the story.
Stephen Russell sent St Kevin's parents and guardians a letter announcing his resignation. In part, it reads,
"In my time at St Kevin's, I've always tried to put the school before self and the students' well-being at the very top of my list of priorities. I believe the current situation means that the best way to achieve this is to resign. I have a deep and abiding passion for this school community and am very grateful for the 24 years of nurturing I and my family have received. I extend my best wishes and encouragement to the current student body to be good people, the way so many who went before them have been across the decades."
Luke Macaronis finished Year 12 at St Kevin's in 2016 and spoke to Four Corners about the school's culture. He's told PM Mr Russell's resignation is a step in the right direction.
"Many boys and parents have reached out to me expressing their distress because Stephen Russell was such a significant leader for such a long time at the school and is really responsible for a lot of progress and a lot of the school's success. While that is true, I think there are bigger questions about the ways that the school responded to problems and the ways that the school wanted to grow its culture. And I think while Mr. Russell was good at some points, there were other places where he clearly failed the boys."
And what were those, do you think?
"I think looking at the culture of pride at the school and the culture of image at the school that looked to keep a really strict and strong image was one that ultimately didn't help in the end because it allowed secrecy and systems of abuse to perpetuate. And that's a really serious concern. But there's also a broader issue about the way that the school in the last few decades operated, the way that it's treated staff who are women, the way it's offered them leadership opportunities. There are big questions about systems of nepotism and loyalty at the school. And also, I think, questions about how the school responds in times of crisis."
Why do you think Paris Street was treated the way he was when those grooming allegations arose?
I think the way that the leadership at St Kevin's understood the findings of the Royal Commission into institutional abuse of children and the way that the school understood its responsibility to the students was maybe too centred on their public image and too centred on the way that an institution and an organisation should function. Instead, I think it should have been centred on boys' experiences and boys' voices. It should have been centred on those failures and those vulnerabilities, and it should have been open and transparent about that.
The school has already announced Stephen Russell will be replaced for the time being by John Crowley, the headmaster of St Patrick's College in Ballarat. It has a shocking history of sexual abuse of students by both priests and Christian brothers. But Mr Crowley has won the respect of his school community and the men who are abused at the school by his determination to tackle its history of child sexual abuse and make the campus safe for today's students. He ensured St Pat's was the first school in Victoria to introduce the Keeping Safe child protection curriculum. He spoke to the ABC in 2017.
As a school without history, we felt that there was such an important obligation now to make sure that we provided leadership in this area. I guess it just really does draw the line in the sand in terms of, as a school community, where we believe our support needs to be.
The grooming offences outlined on Four Corners on Monday night drew the attention of Sky News commentator Andrew Bolt.
That headmaster that she mentioned, who gave a character reference for a man who was an ex-teacher who hit on a boy at that school. No sex occurred, hit on the boy, later jailed for grooming. The headmaster gave a character reference and has since been absolutely pilloried on the ABC radio today.
Paris Street, the victim of sports coach Peter Keogh's grooming, has told Four Corners his experience has been an exhausting and debilitating process, but he hopes Mr. Russell's resignation represents a shift in the school's attitudes and that child safety will now be its number one priority.
Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, social commentator and Guardian Australia journalist David Marr says institutions that try to protect themselves when they've done wrong must be hit where it hurts, in the hip pocket. He joined me earlier. David Marr, some people are seeing this St. Kevin's matter as a problem of the Catholic Church. Is it that or is it something else in your view?
Well, it's been a huge problem with the Catholic Church, as the Royal Commission has revealed. But it's deeper than that, because it's not just the Catholic Church. These kinds of problems have been in the Anglican Church, in the Presbyterian Church, and in other organisations, nothing to do with churches. This was an organisation protecting itself at the cost of the children. And it's a profound impulse to keep things secret, to see if you can get away with it, to make sure the public doesn't hear about it. And it's completely remarkable that a headmaster of a school like St. Kevin's should be trying this on at the height of the Royal Commission. But he did. He was protecting his institution, and it didn't matter that this was mashing up the kids.
But in his resignation statement, he's told the families of students at the school and others who have now read it that it was always the children he put first. You don't doubt that he genuinely believes that, do you?
He may believe it, but in this case, according to reports, I can only go on those reports and the wonderful Four Corners on Monday night, no support was given to Paris Street when his complaint reached the school. He was left dangling, and all of the support by the school appears to have been given to the coach, and the headmaster gave the coach a character reference after he was convicted. And the thing here is that it was a closed court because Paris was a child, and perhaps the headmaster and the other members of the staff, like Mr. Travers, the sportsmaster, believed that it would always remain secret, but that was also a foolish misjudgment on their part.
You say this is an institution protecting itself. Is this also about masculine culture, that phrase we have now, toxic masculine culture?
I don't think so. This is about the culture of a prestige institution that charges very high fees, has a very high reputation as an educational institution, protecting its market and protecting its reputation.
And you mentioned, of course, that this was all playing out as the Royal Commission into institutional child sexual abuse was unfolding in front of us in such terrible detail. If a Royal Commission doesn't awaken institutions to the nature of the problem, what's it going to take?
Well, it's going to require public scrutiny to continue in this field. There is a sense in the community, firstly, that the Royal Commission did a superb job, and secondly, that somehow the problem is now solved. It's interesting that it's actually quite hard to sell stories of abuse and institutional indifference to abuse these days to the press, because it seems to be something that is settled and done with. But what Louise Milligan showed so superbly on Four Corners is that it is not done with, and there is so much still continuing.
And one of the instincts in these sorts of situations is for institutions to bring in trainers, experts to try to make cultural change. Do you give that any truck? Do you think that sort of approach is effective, or are we looking at something more societal, deeper?
I think it's a very good start, but maybe, Linda, I'm harsh and old-fashioned, but when institutions behave as badly as St Kevin's behave, they have to be punished. That's what makes them see sense. Now, I hear that there was, it's been reported, that there has been a civil settlement between the school and the abused young man, and that is part of the punishment as well. Having to pay money is a very, very effective punishment for these institutions. When the assets are challenged, they find a moral sense that they has eluded them in the past.
David Marr, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
David Marr from The Guardian Australia. A horrific car fire in a Brisbane suburb today has left three children dead, their mother in hospital with critical injuries, and a city stunned. In an apparent act of family violence, it's alleged Rowan Baxter, a former NRL player who also died in the fire, set the car alight. The details we have are distressing, so just a warning on that. Here's Rachel Mealy in Brisbane.
I'm standing on Raven Street in Camp Hill. It's a suburb in Brisbane, which is about a 20-minute drive south of the CBD. As I look down the street, I can see a police tent that's been erected over the burnt-out car. A fire engine is parked beside the tent, and firemen and women and police officers are surrounding the scene. Some of them are in those blue hazmat suits. There's police tape around what I think is the family's home and another car. Neighbours are coming out of their houses every now and then. Some are sharing the horrific tale of what unfolded here this morning.
My first scene was a lady on, you know, under a hose with skin falling off her body. You know, now we're finding out children. We suspect, or well, it's talked about a male perpetrator, three children in a car. You know, an act of cruelty, which is incredibly terrible. And it's just the nice people in the street went to help. People have been hurt emotionally and physically by what's happened. And the poor old police and ambos and fireys are all impacted as well by such a terrible tragedy. You know, it's just absolutely awful.
So did you hear the screams and come out of your house?
Or? Oh, I heard some sort of, I thought it was a smoke alarm or something at first, and then I came out and I saw neighbours and a hose. A very kind lady had the hose over the female that was in the vehicle. We believe she was in the vehicle. And again, you know, her activewear had been burnt off, and her skin was, you know, it was hanging off her body. And it was just horrific for those that have seen it. And you know, there's grandparents, no doubt, and friends and family and childcare providers that are all going to be touched by this. And, you know, it's just awful. There's no rhyme or reason for such a thing to happen, you know. It's just terribly sad. Sad day for Camp Hill and Brisbane.
Neighbours rushed to the burning car to help. One man who tried to open the doors of the car suffered burns to his face and is recovering in hospital. Detective Inspector Mark Thompson says police arrived to a distressing scene.
Look, we've all got different experiences in life and at work. I've seen some horrific scenes. This is up there with some of the best of them. It's a terrible scene. And like I said, we've got three deceased children, a deceased adult male and a critically injured female. So, a terrible thing to be presented with, but we'll work through it.
As the news of what had happened spread, this woman arrived at the scene to lay flowers.
It is just absolutely tragic that we can live in a country as beautiful as we do, surrounded by these, you know, multi-million dollar homes. Just such a stunning part of our city. I love Brisbane. And yet these things can be happening right in front of us. You know, and I just think it's a call to everyone, every neighbour, every friend, every colleague at work. What are we doing to support people in this situation? Because it's not okay for this to keep happening.
Brisbane resident Jemima Black, Rachel Mealy, our reporter in Brisbane. You're listening to PM on the radio. We're on the ABC Listen app as well, and we're a podcast. I'm Linda Mottram on Twitter. I'm at Linda Mottram. Now, are you sometimes frustrated that a broken device or appliance can't seem to be fixed? You have to consign it to landfill. Well, there is a growing push against the manufacturers that stand in the way of repairs. Stay listening. When you're underpaid for years on end, it can be, social workers tell us, the straw that breaks the camel's back. When your employer's negligence, failing to pay you properly, means you just can't afford life's basics. Well, Target is today's addition to the list of companies confessing to shortchanging workers to the tune of $9 million, just a day after Coles joined the queue. Is this deliberate exploitation of workers or a failure to seriously ensure that workers get what is their right? Our business reporter David Taylor has more.
I know it's a terrible cliche, but another day and another major Australian company found shortchanging its workers. Yesterday it was Coles, today it's Target.
So many instances I think people aren't aware that they're actually underpaid. They are desperate to get money in, to pay their bills and to cover their expenses. So they do just accept what is on offer to them.
Kristen Hartnett is a caseworker with the Salvation Army. She's told PM she's seen an increase in underpaid casual staff coming through the Salvo's doors, looking for help.
And we can see that people who are working really hard to make ends meet, delivering really good quality products and a good service where they are, finding it just hard to keep going because the hourly rate really doesn't cover their living expenses. I think there's an increasing amount of people through our services who are on casual wages, you know, casual employment, and definitely those people are extremely vulnerable.
As it stands, the total amount owing to underpaid workers is roughly $400 million, and the list of companies caught up in the mess is extensive. The ABC admitted to underpaying around 2,500 casual staff. Qantas came out to say that an error had caused 55 of its workers to be underpaid. The Commonwealth Bank blamed, quote, errors in the system for underpaying over 8,000 staff over 10 years. Late last year, Woolworths revealed it underpaid workers to the tune of $300 million. And just this week, Coles and Target, owned by Wesfarmers, have underpaid their workers by $20 and $9 million respectively. The main group representing bosses told us yesterday these are all examples of honest payroll mistakes. Here's the Australian industry group's Innes Willocks again.
They've self-reported to the authorities and they've set about making it right.
Wesfarmers boss Rob Scott, who's ultimately responsible for a number of companies who have been underpaying workers, including Target, drove that message home again today.
People should be judged by how they respond to the issue. We've identified the issue and really I think the reputation of businesses and future action should be determined by how people respond to this issue now that it has been identified.
But industrial relations expert John Buchanan says that's nonsense.
When I've done workplace studies, for example, you'll talk to employers and they'll all say they pay the award rate. But when you probed on that, you said, well, exactly what rate, you would find they were paying the minimum rate. They weren't actually paying the rate that was appropriate to the classification. And that's all part of a culture of people saying they're thinking they're compliant by complying with the absolute minimum rate, when in fact the award system is far more comprehensive than that. And that to me is, once again, like I say, not a matter of each individual employer making an individual mistake. It's part of a broader culture of de facto non-compliance. A lot of these people aren't consciously going out there, but the culture itself has changed. They're not actually paying that much attention to the detail.
Wage data from the Bureau of Statistics today also confirms that pay rises aren't keeping pace with cost of living increases. The Salvation Army's Kristen Hartnett says workers are already struggling to make ends meet. So when they're also underpaid, it can tip them into poverty.
I think each situation is so individual. I have a tension between, I see incredible resilience from some people who can recover from that, but then I see if this lack of pay has come at a time of other situations, it can be the straw that breaks the camel's back. So it's a situation by situation. Of course, we all want our due pay on the day that we are deserved it. So we just encourage people, if they are thinking they're in that position of being underpayment, to speak up.
Tristan Hartnett speaking to our reporter David Taylor. Well, tonight we want to give you a feel for what it's like if you are escaping the bombs that are raining down on in northeastern Syria, what it's like when it suddenly becomes urgent to take your family and run. Last week we spoke to a teacher living in western Aleppo with his family. His name is Abdul Kafi Alhamdo. He, along with 3 to 4 million others, are in the firing line as the Syrian regime, backed by Russian forces, close in on the final rebel stronghold in the country. And in the past day, he was forced to flee as well. Here's a compilation of messages he sent us.
My house and their house is next to the hospitals that were targeted. The first, a rocket that was horrifying. I went out to see what's happening. I saw very close smokes. And while the plane was in the sky, so I went back to my house and my kids. I heard that horrible sound. So we all landed on the ground, and shrapnels started to come everywhere, and everything turned black. We didn't see at the beginning anything. After that, my kids were crying. I hold them both. I held my wife. I told them, let's go. I got out with my kids.
People don't know what to do. People don't know where to go. It's our doomsday.
Fleeing Syrian teacher Abdul Kafi Alhamdo. He's one of now close to 1 million, the UN says, who are on the run, moving, then being forced to move again as the regime pushes them ever closer to the Turkish border. Temperatures have also been sub-zero. Food, shelter and medical supplies are limited. Syria's leader Bashar al-Assad has pledged to continue the onslaught to complete victory. Mark Cutts is the United Nations Deputy Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Syria crisis. He's on the Turkey-Syria border. I asked him to describe conditions.
It's been going on for months, and the front lines have been shifting constantly, and the bombs have just been following these people wherever they go. We've seen almost 1 million people who have fled their homes in the last 2.5 months, most of them moving northwards or westwards to areas closer to the Turkish border. But many of them have had to flee multiple times, including just in the last few days, as displacement camps were hit by shelling. And as I say, it's just panic on the ground. People fleeing in all directions.
And so people have had to move multiple times in recent years, and now they're being forced to pick up and move on because the bombs keep getting closer?
Yes, this is a massive displacement crisis. The whole of Syria is a displacement crisis. This 9 years of war has displaced 12 million people. But of the displaced people inside the country, many of them are in the northwest part of Syria. So these are people that came from other places where there were big battles over the last few years, in places like Homs, Aleppo, Raqqa, eastern Ghouta, and they all eventually fled to this northwest corner of Syria. They went there for refuge, thinking that they would be safe there. But now this has become by far the most dangerous place in the whole of Syria. I mean, this is the most dangerous place in the world to be right now if you're a civilian.
But there's nowhere to go, is there? Because the border to Turkey is closed. Turkey won't let these people in, and they're surrounded. It is a dire scenario. What happens to these people if the bombing doesn't stop?
Well, we have to ensure that if these people cannot move across the border into Turkey, then they must be protected within the borders of their own country. And unfortunately, that's not what's been happening. We've just seen, all kinds of civilian infrastructure has been hit. Residential areas, marketplaces have been hit. There have been huge casualties, more than 1,700 civilians killed in the last 10 months. Most of them are women and children. So, this is a protection crisis. It's a real failure of the entire international community to protect some of the most vulnerable people in the world.
Tell me about the attempt to offer humanitarian assistance. I mean, given what you're describing, it must be extraordinarily difficult logistically for you.
It is difficult, but, the credit needs to go to the Syrian humanitarian workers inside northwest Syria. They're the ones who are running the remaining hospitals and clinics. And so we have a massive aid operation, but it's extremely difficult and dangerous. Three of our humanitarian colleagues were killed in the last couple of weeks. Many of our humanitarian colleagues inside the Idlib area have had to flee with their families in recent weeks. So it's, you know, it's just mayhem inside that area at the moment.
The UN has just appealed for $336 million in new funding to try to add the aid that's available. What exactly would that be spent on? What's the priority?
Well, the priority, more than anything else, is to stop the fighting and to ensure the safety of these people. So some of the money is going on humanitarian organisations that are helping to evacuate people out of frontline areas. But a lot of it goes on food. A lot of the money is going on tents, blankets, plastic sheeting, you know, stoves and all kinds of other relief items for a huge population on the move.
In the past day, we've heard Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader, say he will continue with this campaign. Who do you think can stop it?
Well, we need an agreement in the Security Council, but they've been gridlocked there, and we need them to overcome individual interests and put the needs of the civilian population first. This is a situation where you've got more than 3 million people trapped in a war zone, and they must be protected.
Mark Cutts, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Cutts is the United Nations Deputy Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Syria crisis. He's on the Turkey-Syria border. Something a bit closer to home. Someone in our house recently replaced a solenoid in the washing machine, and that fixed a problem that the manufacturer had suggested had made the appliance a bin job. I don't think it's too uncommon to hear people's frustrations with that sort of situation. Why can't it be fixed, we ask. Well, there is some hope in a growing push against the manufacturers that don't want you to fix your appliance or device. The Right to Repair movement has seen laws passed in Europe recently to mandate that repair should be easier and cheaper. The US is considering legislation, and Australia is being urged to follow suit, as Annie Guest reports.
Computer hard drives being pulled apart by volunteers at a recycling facility in Logan, south of Brisbane. Whitney Lindsay is the administrator of Substation 33.
We get a lot of TVs, a lot of computers and a lot of home appliances.
The goods are then repaired or recycled at this not-for-profit social enterprise, which trains unemployed people in the process.
TVs and computers we work with a lot. We found them to be quite fixable. Things like home appliances is where it gets a little bit tricky.
Whitney Lindsay has six functioning tablet computers rendered obsolete. Professor Leanne Wiseman is an expert in intellectual property law from Griffith University.
Any smart good or device that you have in your home has a computer chip embedded in it. So what happens then is those computer chips are basically locked up by the manufacturers.
Unlocking the code and opening up a quick and easy fix is the aim of an international movement calling itself Right to Repair. They want regulations overhauled.
It was never envisaged that these digital locks and technological protection measures would be used over your coffee machine or your dishwasher or your refrigerator.
One of the areas where you've said this is very relevant is in repairing smartphones, but however, you can go to the high street repairer and have it fixed.
Often it will cost you quite a lot of money, but also Apple have a history of making their devices difficult to repair.
Apple declined an interview but pointed to its announcement in August that it would provide more parts and information to Apple authorised repairers. That wasn't enough for the European Union, which passed laws in October to require easier repairs. Professor Taina Piklarina is from the University of Helsinki.
It also demands the manufacturers to design the product so that they are easier to repair.
She spoke to PM at a Right to Repair workshop organised by Griffith University in Brisbane recently. Professor Leah Chan-Grinvold from Suffolk University in Boston
says the United States could follow the EU.
Currently in the United States, we have over 20 states, approximately 20 states, looking at passing a right to repair law that should allow consumers the ability to repair their own products by obtaining information as well as parts.
The Australian government has previously said it would mandate the sharing of car servicing information. And last year it indicated the Productivity Commission could be asked to examine the broader right to repair issue, but it told PM it had not received any terms of reference. PM sought comment from manufacturers through the Australian Industry Group, but they declined to respond.
Annie Guest reporting. And that's PM for this Wednesday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join us again at the same time tomorrow. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
The whole world is trying to figure out where coronavirus will spread to next. So could artificial intelligence have the answer to that question?
Today, the AI that knows more about how this outbreak moves than any government in the world.
Find The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.